Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Back here at the Big Show, I'm Glenn Ordway. Tony Maserati and Steve Buckley joining us on today's Big Show and joining us live right now, General Manager of the Red Sox, Theo Epstein. Welcome to Home Opener 2, Theo.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, Theo.
Sort of like a second opening day. See, most teams have the home opener, and then the next day everybody puts their feet up, and, you know, it's kind of a relaxing day.
It's a hangover
day.
Game.
It's a hangover game. A lot of people don't even show up at the ballpark. Here, this might be more emotional tonight than what we experienced yesterday.
Yeah, a little different than in San Diego. We'd have about 9,000 second game of the year.
Theo, how did you feel overall about specifically Beckett's performance yesterday?
Felt great, you know, about the way the whole team played. Josh's performance was, you know, particularly exciting for us to see. I mean, he's really been that way since day one of spring training. He's really slowed down his delivery, very much in control of what he's doing out there, obviously incorporating more secondary stuff, two-seamer, as well as the changeup and the curveball. And it's great to see. You know, he talked a lot about making adjustments from last year and from being fastball dominant last year and giving up all the home runs. He's really executed those adjustments with the help of Jason Varitek and John Farrell. So we're excited to see him in this form and hope it keeps up.
We were talking about him last hour because we had him on the show last week. And do you find his whole approach a lot different? He just seemed to be far more mature to me. He revealed stuff that he dealt with last year and not only revealed them, but kind of gave a game plan as to what he needs to do, almost like he's figured it all out.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And, you know, we talked at the end of last year, you know, when he was getting some criticism about this being the natural time in a pitcher, particularly a power pitcher's career, when he makes those adjustments. You've seen it with almost, you know, most elite power pitchers, a la Curt Schilling, go through that type of adjustment where they stop just throwing and really learn what their strengths are, figure out how to address some of their weaknesses, and figure out how to pitch. And, you know, Josh got a baptism under fire last year in the American League and had a extremely productive offseason, not only from a physical standpoint, continuing this, you know, the maintenance with his shoulder, but also from a mental standpoint. And I think John Farrell had a very impactful meeting with him, flew to Texas, and they spent an afternoon together. And Josh deserves a ton of credit for growing up in a hurry and making those adjustments. And, you know, this is a guy who already was one of the elite pitchers in baseball, you know, back in 2003 at a very young age. But I think now, you know, a lot of the things he's doing are not by accident. He has a plan. He's executing it. It bodes very well for the future.
Theo, I think that you'll agree that every game that Curt Schilling pitches this season will in some measure be a referendum on whether or not you should have given him the money before this season begins. And without tipping your hand on where that might be going down the road, is there a witty byplay between the two of you when you bump into each other in the hallways? How is that all playing out right now?
They're blogging to each other.
Are you blogging with him? Or?
You guys, trust me on this one. This is one that is a much, much, much bigger deal in the media and on the talk shows than it is in reality. I don't buy into the fact that every game is a referendum on how it'll be.
I think you're missing the point. I think it will be on this end.
It is on your end, but it's just noise. It doesn't mean anything.
But with the fans and you can't say that the 35,000 fans, it's just noise. It's all part of the process.
No, it is just noise. From our perspective, from Kurt's perspective, it's noise. And from our perspective, it's noise. And those are the only two perspectives that really matter when it comes to, you know, the relationship between a player and the club. We're obviously in this together and trying to win. And you don't look at game by game and see how a player is doing. We, you know, the fact that we didn't want to sign Kurt doesn't mean that we don't think he's going to have a good year. I think in all probability he's going to have an extremely good year. But it doesn't change the fact that it might not be the wisest thing in the world to commit over a year in advance a lot of money to a pitcher who's going to be 41 years old next year.
No, I happen to agree with that point of view. What I'm saying is that you guys, when you guys get together and you see each other, it's all cool is what I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and, you know, it always has been. I think it always will be. And in fact, the dialogue about the contract when it was time to talk about the contract was very direct, very cordial. And I think it was for at least a day or two portrayed otherwise in the media because of a look Kurt had or a gesture he gave John Henry, which was all fabricated. You know, it was extremely professional, extremely cordial between both sides. Sure, he was disappointed, but he completely understood. And we've never been on opposite sides of that particular table.
Theo, since Buck introduced the topic of giving away money, I am recognizing that we're a week into the season. Do you feel at all vindicated by how J.D. Drew has started this season?
No, not based on 1 week's worth of play. You know, the same way if he were 0-25 the way he started in L.A., we wouldn't be panicking. And it wouldn't affect the way we see him as a player. I mean, we've always liked him as a player. We thought this offseason he was a particularly good fit to address a couple of our needs. And, there was a strategy and a process with which we went about pursuing him and acquiring him. You know, there are reasons for it. The fact that he's off to a good start is great, great for him, great for the club. It doesn't change sort of the merits of signing him in the first place. We're happy for him that he gets to sort of start his home campaign with some momentum here, but it's something that it's a signing that was not without risk, but made a lot of sense on a lot of different levels, and we're certainly happy to have him.
Theo, the game or the series in Kansas City last week, there were a couple of scouts from the National League sitting behind the plate, and one of them asked us in the press box a simple question and said, "Oh, has Drew hit any tape measure homers yet?" And Does he at all surprise you with his power, given that when you look at him, he's not exactly Willie Mopena?
Yeah, he's always been that way. He doesn't lift a lot of weights, but he's kind of country strong, extremely strong wrists and forearms. And one of the reasons we thought he was a good fit for Fenway is that he can't hit tape measure home runs, particularly when he pulls the ball. I think we'll see quite a few over the bullpen this year. So right field for left-handed hitter can be limiting. Trout Nixon hit one home run at Fenway last year. It can just be limiting for a guy who doesn't have a plus raw power because that's quite a poke to right field. But in JD's case, when he does pull the ball, it goes a long way. He won't have any problem there. And as he showed yesterday, he's got the ability to go out to center and left field as well. So we thought he's a pretty good fit for this ballpark, and he will hit some eye-opening home runs.
I thought that one was shocking yesterday. When it left his bat, I thought there was no chance that was getting out.
But
it looked
Ichiro
like,
had it this
looked like Ichiro had it. Looked like he was circling it and had it. Next thing you know, it's out of the ballpark. That, talk about deceiving power. That was, I don't know about country power. What is country power anyway?
It's just power from a guy who sort of naturally has it.
Oh, all right.
Not a product of the weight room.
Thought that was one of those southern terms or
Glenn,
something.
Glenn, I'll tell you, if you see this guy, he looks pretty ordinary.
Yeah, he does.
He doesn't
look
like a muscle head.
No, I agree.
Old-fashioned ball player.
Old-school baseball player.
Yeah, very much so.
Well,
Remy described him this morning, and you hate to do it and throw high expectations, but he brought up Fred Lynn's name. And there was a little bit of that in that he does everything so effortlessly. I mean, the fly ball that he chased down in Kansas City, if you remember, in the gap, it didn't look like it was a great catch. You watch it again, and you say, he got a great jump on it and traveled a long distance to get there. I guess there's no question that health is really the concern with him, and Tony brought up the money with it, because there's no question you found yourself a very good baseball player. What gives you the feeling that he's going to be worth that type of money from a health standpoint? What makes you assured that he's going to stay pretty healthy here, Theo?
Well, two of the last three seasons, played 145 or more games. The one season that he didn't, it was because he broke his wrist getting hit by a pitch, which is a non-reoccurring injury, it's a fluke injury. So basically the last 3 years he's been healthy. There are a lot of players who are injured for the first half of their careers and stay remarkably healthy in the second half of their careers. If you actually study it throughout baseball history, injuries are not as predictive, as don't have as much predictive value as you might think they have. In other words, just because a player's been hurt in the past, there's a natural tendency to think, well, this guy's injury-prone, he's going to be injured in the future. It does happen that way sometimes, but not as often as people think. So this guy, from a talent standpoint, we actually thought was the best player on the market, and he certainly signed for a lot less than the Carlos Lees of the world and other players who might be a little bit one-dimensional. So we actually thought,
Gary Matthews,
if he does stay healthy, he's actually good value. I think most people think we overpaid for him from a talent standpoint. Given the rest of the market, we actually thought we underpaid for him, but a lot of that, but that was discounted for the injury factor, and we do have some protection for the shoulder, which we hope and expect will never be a factor. So, look, it was a signing with some risk, but I thought we were in a position to take some risk given how good a fit he was for our needs this past offseason.
All right, the other criticism we have heard is that he has a laissez-faire attitude, doesn't care much. Now, I just described him as doing everything effortlessly. I guess when you're hitting, that's probably the way you describe it. And when a guy is not hitting, probably people say he doesn't care much or has a laissez-faire attitude. Did you investigate all that stuff and try to find out exactly what he was like and the way he approached the game, knowing that he was going to be playing in a city that seems to scrutinize every single at-bat and every single play in the field?
We did. You know, we've talked about this on these airwaves and others before. Baseball players get labeled. It's just part of the industry, and they often get labeled really earlier in the career, when they're just coming into pro ball or when they first debut in the big league. JD had a lot going against him. He was, you know, one of the most talented college players in history, and then ended up, you know, sitting out a year and had most of pro ball critical of him before he even put on a professional uniform. And then some things happened earlier in his career with the nagging injuries where I think he got labeled. And you know, who knows if as a young kid maybe there was some merit to it, but certainly I think that label – labels are often unfair, and we thought in his case it was as well. I think the point you made about JD playing the game so naturally and so effortlessly that he sometimes appears as if he's not trying hard, there's a lot to be said for that. And I think, you know, the guys who have to play max effort all the time and have emotional reactions and throwing their helmets and getting dirty oftentimes become fan favorites and even scouts' favorites or organizational favorites, whereas the players who are trying just as hard but don't appear to be so because they're such natural players sometimes don't get that same reputation, sometimes are labeled as being soft or not playing hard or being laissez-faire and not caring. So I think, you know, that wasn't necessarily the case. In JD's case, he knows himself extremely well as a player. He knows the pace at which he plays. He knows his strengths. He knows his weaknesses. He knows sort of his role in the clubhouse. And we didn't bring him here to be the guy. We didn't bring him here to be an emotional leader. We brought him here to play the game the right way, to produce on the field, and be a good teammate, but not necessarily a leader. We have leaders in that clubhouse, Jason Varitek, David Ortiz of the world. So JD's been a breath of fresh air, frankly, since day one of spring training. I think his teammates will tell you the same.
Theo, Youkilis made an interesting point yesterday when he said that there's been so much Daisuke Matsuzaka hype and media and so forth already this season, that as they go into tonight's game, they're prepared for it, that just as spring training prepares players to hit, pitch, and throw, and so forth, that they are prepared for the rigors of a season with all that accompanies the Daisuke mania. Did you guys actually sit down with players before or during spring training to educate them on this, or did you just sort of let it flow and see how it played out?
There wasn't much formal education. I think informally we talked about it with most of the guys. It's about his stature in Japan and what to expect. I guess the one formal thing, during our talk with the players, the first full day of spring training, we challenged them to take a phenomenon, namely the increased volume of media, and take something that could be a negative or a distraction and turn it into a positive, and to sort of embrace the multicultural nature of our clubhouse as they always have in the past and turn it into a positive for the club and for themselves individually. And I've been wholly impressed with how our players have done that. You know, there hasn't been a negative word spoken. They've embraced Daisuke and Hideki and the whole phenomenon, and I think I've done a great job of handling it with maturity and turning it into a positive. So it's a great point Uke makes, though, that I think, you know, what is it, his second appearance of the year, but as players in the clubhouse and as an organization, I think we're pretty well prepared for what to expect and can just compete, trying to get 27 outs with more runs scored than the opposition the way we do every other game.
Well, Theo, as a follow-up, as a guy who grew up in Brookline, you're as steeped in Red Sox history as anybody because you're from here. You obviously know that the history of the franchise in terms of race relations is not a particularly good one. Do you think that the franchise, because of the way you've embraced Jackie Robinson and the cover of your media guide has the flags of different countries, that you've sort of, I don't want to say cleansed the franchise, but certainly taken a different direction?
Well, I think it takes it'll take many more years to actually completely cleanse, if, you know, using your word, because of the the history and some of the shameful episodes in the past, but I think John, Tom, and Larry deserve a lot of credit for making a priority, and that's really trickled down to the whole organization. So when I said that the players have embraced the multicultural element of our clubhouse as, with Daisuke and Hideki as they have in the past, it's because I think we've had a very tolerant, very understanding, very open, very diverse clubhouse for the last several years, at least as long as I've been here and can remember, with African-American players, with Latin American players, and you know, that attitude of tolerance and acceptance of diversity and the benefits that come with it has been prevalent here. So I think it's great that you know, as the business side is promoting that, our fans are becoming exposed to it and appreciating it. It just makes for a better overall organization.
I thought they were interesting comments you just made, dealing with the past history of this ball club, because in many instances you guys have tried to hold on to the history of the team, and yet there's another side of it, which I think you just unveiled, and I think we all that have grown up here have lived through. And I wonder, when you're trying to embrace the past and the history of this ball club, how much of it do you have to, in a delicate manner, maybe in a delicate manner, maybe you don't have to do it in a delicate, certainly
not
sound
delicate.
Like you were delicate right there in that comment. How do you also, to use Buck words, cleanse the past and let people know that everything has changed? Obviously, actions speak louder than words, but how can you embrace the past and yet still expose the past of this Red Sox history?
Well, I think by being honest about it. I mean, if you were a high school history teacher, you know, you're not just going to teach your students, you know, the elements of history that make everyone look good and are warm and fuzzy. You're going to also tackle head on.
Bring a little Howard Zinn in there.
Exactly. You're going to tackle the parts of history that we're less proud of and that are more shameful. I think, you know, as the Red Sox, there's a lot to be proud of, but, you know, the one area where, we've been behind the curve and we've had, you know, some disgraces in the past has been race relations. So that all the more reason for this ownership group and this front office to be proactive in, you know, establishing a diverse atmosphere and acceptance, a tolerance, and a celebration of the diversity in the game now. So you're right, Glenn. I just think the way to deal with it is not to hide from it.
Leo, good for you.
Theo, is there any doubt after Sunday night and watching Jonathan Papelbon that this guy was born to be a closer? He was Goose Gossage-esque in that five-out save the other night. And, you know, please tell me that he's never going to leave that role again.
Well, never say never, but he's certainly, you know, he's proven that I think he's one of the top handful of guys on this planet at that job. And, you know, I think the only thing missing from this equation is the ability to make an apples-to-apples comparison with, you know, in other words, seeing just how good he'd be as a starting pitcher. And we may never have that opportunity. I think from an objective standpoint, it'd be a lot easier to say, okay, well, we know he's a stud closer, but he's only a number four starter, so it's an easy decision. But, you know, never getting to find out if this guy could be a one or two starter is a tough pill to swallow, but that may be the way it comes down. And I'll tell you what, there's worse things in the world than having a homegrown, drafted and developed stud closer with unbelievable makeup and who's going to be here a long, long time. So we're pretty happy with Jonathan's progress in his career to this point and his role in the club and everything that he stands for. And you know, it's exciting every time he has to come in the game.
You know, for a second there, I thought Pete was going to say, please tell me on behalf of the constituency that the rumors are false. Thank you.
I'll leave that for Bob Ryan. He'll have a follow-up tonight.
Theo, minus Papelbon, how do you feel about the way the rest of the bullpen is coming?
Speaking of, I haven't seen the Bob Ryan J.D. Drew column yet.
Whoa!
Oh!
Public.
No. Bob's great, and I have a great relationship with him. But
it sounds it.
Did.
Yeah. I was saying, minus Papelbon, how do you feel like the rest of the bullpen is coming together?
Pretty good, you know, so far. And I guess I'll address that with a broad lens. I mean, we haven't had a lot of time to get guys into comfortable, familiar roles yet. We haven't played a ton of close games where our starting pitcher's been out after six innings. We've had to figure out how to get nine outs, but that'll come. I think there's a lot to be excited about with the way some of these guys are throwing the ball. And, you know, in AAA, too, we have an extremely deep pitching staff there. DeVern Hanstack just had another great game today. He punched out 10 over five innings. And I think we're better equipped as an organization to withstand, you know, all the attrition that comes our way, particularly with the bullpen over the course of the season. How exactly it's going to shake out, who's going to step up and have great years, who's going to perhaps struggle, and where the depth is going to come from. I can't give you exact names and exact roles yet, but I do know how much more comfortable I feel with the overall depth, including AAA, now than I did this time last year.
We're talking to Theo Epstein. I remember you saying this last year that I forget whether it was a third, or a quarter, the way you broke down the season. And you said there was a period of evaluation, then there was a period of assessment, then there was the period where you've actually got to make the moves.
A third,
was that what it was? Certainly by going out and getting Matsusaka, you clear up a top-of-the-rotation guy that you just couldn't find if you needed to find one in the middle of the season.
Right.
You certainly have added depth into that rotation with guys behind him like Snyder and certainly John Lester on the horizon and others, which you did not do last year, and that seemed to be a problem. You had to bring him in at the last second when guys went down with injuries. The one thing that still does concern me, and obviously that's good you've shored up those things, if the bottom of the order or that bullpen that we just described, where you guys have not had great success in the last couple of years, falters, do you believe this flexibility and that you can find players to fit in those spots to put this team over the top?
I do, and I think I just mentioned that with the bullpen, I think that flexibility might come from within. You know, we have several promising young pitchers, not too far positioned from where a Papelbon was, say, in like 2005, where, and I'm not comparing them talent-wise, but we certainly have guys who by midway or two-thirds of the way through the season can be positioned to really help, not let alone the depth that I think is already major league ready at AAA. So who knows, we might make a bullpen move if a need arises during the year, but I also wouldn't be surprised to see some guys step up from the minor leagues and make a real impact. With respect to the bottom of the order, I think there's a lot to be excited about with each guy, and you want to see a large body of work before you make any evaluations. But, you know, if we're in a position in July where we think we can improve the club by making a move, certainly. You know, I think we have a top third-tier farm system and the ability to make moves if we have to.
One of those guys, Jacoby Ellsbury, I think he was, 4-for-6 or
three doubles last night.
How fast an ascension do you see him on this team? If Coco continues to hit 160, is it possible that this guy could actually help this major league roster by, you know, before the All-Star break if he continues on that kind of a pace or close to it?
This is the noise you were talking about.
Well, I'm trying to be totally honest with you.
In fact, most of the noise comes from that booth.
I think Jacoby's ready to make an impact at the major league level right now defensively, but offensively, there's no substitute for the at-bats that you get in the minor leagues. Continue your development. If we rush this guy to the big leagues, he's probably never going back. He's never going to get those 1,000 at bats that he probably needs to develop into a complete hitter. Make no mistake, he's an extremely exciting player and has a very high ceiling and can be a potential plus defender and a leadoff hitter. And he's going to probably make an impact on the franchise for a long time. But he's also got 500 minor league at bats under his belt. Has a long way to go, so it's not by accident they started the year Double A. I'm sure he'll move to Triple A at some point if he continues to have success at the Double A level. But he's on the verge of thrusting himself into the big league picture, but he's not there yet.
All right, one more question. I said this the other day. I really don't care what Jason Veritek hits, and I was happy that he had a good day at the plate yesterday. I really don't care because I think he's just so valuable at what he brings to that pitching staff behind the plate. But he has reached that age in which, if you look back at the history, even the great Johnny Bench started to wear offensively. He's so important behind the plate. Are you concerned about that, in that the history tells us that this is when catchers start to struggle at the plate, and you need him behind that plate? And what are your alternative plans if you lose a Jason Veritek for a while, especially in that he's such a strong influence on that pitching staff, a guy that's seeing American pitching for the first time, and a couple other guys that probably need his influence back there?
Well, a couple things. One, you're right. I mean, Jason's an invaluable part of the team just from a pitching and defense standpoint. It's really like having an extra pitching coach out there, and he provides tremendous stability. And the preparation that he does is unparalleled. As far as his offense goes, I still think he's going to have a good offensive season. I mean, holding him to standards, what he accomplished in 2004 might be unreasonable to hold any catcher to, but I still think he has a chance to be well above average offensive catcher. And that's really what you should do, is compare him to other catchers. If you take a look at what Jason hits at the end of the year and what his on-base is and what he slugs, and then look at other catchers around the league, I think he'll prove to be an offensive asset. We don't plan on losing Jason for any period of time, to get to the second part of your question, but if we did, we have a veteran catch-and-throw guy in AAA and Kevin Cash, and we have a 23-year-old very promising prospect, George Gutierrez, who gets on base and made tremendous strides defensively. Transformation in a brief period of time like I've never seen before, from a fringy defensive player to, in my mind, an above-average defensive player now, thanks to Gary Tuck and Rob Leary and others working with him. So he hits left-handed, Cash hits right-handed, and we have Doug Mirabelli at the big league level. So I think catching is thin throughout Major League Baseball, and having those four guys makes us as deep as anybody else.
Well, you never intend to lose anybody, but the point I'm trying to make is you seem to be really vulnerable there if anything does happen to him. And when a guy is 35 years of age, the chances are more likely something's going to happen, and to get back out on the field seems to take a lot longer when they're that age. Do you believe that you've got to go out and maybe try to improve your depth at that position sometime this year?
I don't think that's possible. If you look at what catching's like around Major League Baseball, I think we have a veteran we trust at AAA for defense and catching and throwing, and we have left-handed hitting 23-year-old kid that we think can really hit and is close to being able to handle a big league pitching staff. So we're always looking, and sure, it'd be great to go trade for stud catcher, another stud catcher to stash at AAA. But between Gutierrez and Cash and Mirabelli, I think we're protected. And, trust Jason.
Well, Theo, let me just jump in real quick because I know we're running out of time. But didn't you trade Castillo because you determined that you could only carry one veteran big league catcher at AAA because you had to have Gutierrez at AAA and you couldn't expect a veteran big league guy go to AA?
Yeah. There's only one out of Cash or Castillo is going to make that club, and our staff in the front office, we evaluated Cash ahead of Castillo, and Gutierrez is the everyday catcher at AAA, continuing his development. That role for the veteran at AAA was to back up Gutierrez, as Cash is doing
right
now.
All right, Theo, thank you very much for joining us. Have a great season, and we all wish you success. How much Japanese, by the way, have you learned? You can get a lot of it down?
No, very little, but I have a cheat sheet book in front of me in case it's ever.
Very nice. Very nice. That'll always work.
Thanks,
all right,
guys.
Theo, have a great one. Thank you very much.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.